represents a looting of what belongs to the people. Privatization represents a transfer of wealth from decently paid union workers to the bosses and owners who thrive off non-union, non-living wage jobs. Postal jobs, unionized postal jobs, have been one of the few areas of true equal opportunity and equal pay for equal work. And that's part of what's under attack right now in the Postal Service. Privatization robs our communities of decent jobs and the positive impact decent jobs have on creating healthy communities. And privatization of postal services will never provide universal and uniform services, because the services will only be provided where a buck can be made. So the very essence of the postal system, to serve whoever we are, wherever we live, no matter our nationality, no matter where we work, no matter how old or young we are, no matter what color skin we have. That's one of the beauties of the public postal service. And that's what we'll be losing. Things would be made on whether somebody can make a buck. And to understand postal privatization, all you have to do is follow the money. The post office revenue is about $65 billion a year with no taxpayer subsidies, money gathered off the people like us who use the postal system. So follow the money. That's what these privatizers are drooling over. And not to wear out the Wall Street Journal, but a couple years ago they had a major guest editorial called Junking the Junk Mail Post Office. And part of it said this, quote, entrepreneurs will see the demise of the United States Postal Service as an opportunity and new companies will emerge. Indeed, this transition can be one of the badly needed bright spots in a troubled American economy. End of quote. That article was penned by somebody named Gary McDougall, and when you read the fine print, he was on the board of directors of United Parcel Service for 34 years. But since the people trust the post office, frontal privatization is not such an easy thing. First, you have to degrade it, undermine it, not have enough people working the windows, have the lines long, have parking where you can't deal with, close early, deliver mail late into the night, and people are going to be forced to look elsewhere. I compared it in our campaign to a lot of what's happened to public education in this country. Before you can destroy it and move in for the kill, you have to undermine it and degrade it. And that's what's happening in the Postal Service. And it's been undermined by both representatives of the two corporate parties. We're functioning under a law, I won't bore you with much of it, from 2006, that forces the Postal Service to pre-fund retiree health care obligations 75 years out for workers that aren't even born yet. It's $5.5 billion a year being drained. It's being stolen out of the postal treasury into the federal treasury. And that law was passed by both parties. Neither of them have been willing to deal with that as well. And there's a new Senate bill called the Carper-Coburn bill that come out, supposed to be postal reform. It's a Democratic Party bill coming out of a Democratic-controlled committee in the Democratic-controlled Senate. It would abolish six-day delivery in due order, short order. It will further delay mail, and it will drive customers more and more into the hands of private services. Now, I do want to share with you that large parts of the Postal Service are already privatized. This is something we have to be very vigilant about. For those of you who have heard of pre-sort discounts, you can't get one. You have to pay the full freight, but the big mailers don't. About 60% of first-class mail is no longer sorted in the post office. It's sorted in what's called pre-sort houses, a big, profitable industry where they get discounts from the Postal Service. They're able to pay their workers $8.50, $9 an hour. And then they keep, the owners keep the profit in between. And companies like Pitney Bowes are in the lead of this. And these very same mailers dictate postal policy, which in turn further enriches them as well. And now we have Staples. You about it already. So the deal with the United States Postal Service and Staples is it's a dirty deal. But it's their post office's five-year plan. Put retail units where you go buy your stamps, mail your packages, and so on, into the private sector. Make deals. We now know, we don't know how much, that the Postal Service is giving Staples a discount on the postal product. A discount. It's our money, it's our Postal Service, and they're giving them a discount. So this is a huge threat to on in regards to further privatization of the post office into the retail side. We represent 78,000 workers who work in the retail side of the Postal Service. And we're proclaiming that the U.S. mail is not for sale, and we're demanding that these units and Staples stores be staffed with postal employees who are accountable to the public and sworn to uphold the sanctity and security. And if Staples and the post office won't do that, then we're in the process of asking people to take their business elsewhere. I do want to share, since I raised the NSA, they really, when you think about it, written postal communication is the last bastion of private communication in this country. So I hope you'll join us in the streets at lunchtime. The buses are going to be out front. And I salute your solidarity. This is going to be first come, first serve solidarity. There's only so many buses, so you're going to rush out to get on there. I think they have room for about 300 people.
Where do you sign up?
But I salute your solidarity. And I'm very pleased to be here speaking at the Labor Notes Conference, because that's been part of the foundation of this organization and conference from the very start. Need more buses. Well, we got a lot of ATU brothers and sisters here. Maybe they're carrying.
Let's take some stuff over.
Take my garage.
You've been listening to KBOO Portland. Mark Dimenstein, the new activist president of the American Postal Workers Union at the Labor Notes Conference.
But solidarity. You know, when we engage in solidarity, we're not doing each other a favor. Solidarity is not an option if we're going to rebuild and revitalize an ever-weakening, in many cases, labor movement. So I salute your solidarity. And by the way, it can't just stay in this room and it can't just stay in this country. We just had a trial a couple days ago at the National Labor Relations Board around getting the Staples contract with the Postal Service. And it came out in evidence that the Postal Service studied, I think it was five different countries, about how to privatize their retail services as part of their assessment of what they were going to try to do here with Staples. And they don't plan to stop at Staples either. So, and I don't, I can't remember what countries those were, but they have no problem looking internationally. And we shouldn't have a problem working internationally either, if we're going to win. We have to have solidarity on all fronts. Before I close, it may be a little long. I was asked to say a few things about our election campaign in the APW. And I'm not going to say that much. But I will say this. We simply told our members the truth as we understood it. We went to the rank and file around this country. We never offered a path of guaranteed or easy victories. The only thing we guaranteed is that if we were elected, we would wage an unrelenting fight alongside with the membership to save the public postal service, to fight to rebuild our union contracts, to fight to save our union, and we promised that we would enter the battlefield with no white flags of surrender. That was our promise. And we asked the members to support us if they wanted a union that was willing to fight back. And our members had been through a bitter experience of a concessionary contract that established multi-tiers, and they had also suffered the repercussions of the closings of hundreds of mail processing centers. And I think on that experience, that was a lot of the basis where the members of the American Postal Workers Union did respond to a call for an activist union leadership. But just like many of you, I do want to point out, just like many of you, we were never dissidents within the American Postal Workers Union. We, members of our slate for national union office, have been in the trenches, local leadership positions for a long time. We supported our union. We united with all those who could be united with on a principle basis over the many years, including with our national leadership at the headquarters level when it was done on a principle basis. And of course, support always includes criticism if it's done in a way to build the labor movement. So that's all I'll say about our campaign. But one of the things we ran on was the need for a grand alliance with the people of this country to save their postal service. Their postal service. And a national alliance in defense of the common good and in defense of what we believe is a democratic right of the people of this country, that universal and uniform postal service. We have much to learn from the Chicago teachers, from the ATU, in terms of how to build strong worker community alliances. We believe that's the only way to allies and their organizations, from seniors to retirees, civil rights, veteran groups, the labor movement, faith-based groups, the Occupy movement, and even some business groups that also need a vibrant postal service as well. But a precursor to this alliance, Brother Jose stole this, the thunder on this, a precursor to building this alliance with the people is building the unity of the four postal unions. We have four postal unions, for those who don't know. The American Postal Workers Union, National Association, Letter Carriers, the Mail Handlers Union, and the Rural Letter Carriers Union. We have been far too divided in the past. And those divisions only help management and guess who else? Of course, the privatizers. So I'm very pleased to share with you, although now it's no secret, that we recently formed the Postal Union Alliance, signed by the four presidents. We're pledging to work together on a number of fronts. And another key to building the Grand Alliance, we believe, is the struggle for postal banking, or what I call the public option to the banking system. And let me just go into that briefly. I don't have notes here, so I'll do it off the top of my head. I think most of us are aware of the predatory legal loan sharking operation that preys on the working poor, the payday loans, the check cashing places, the pawn shops, and so on and so forth. What I didn't realize till recently is just how deep that problem is. There's 68 million adults that don't have access to a bank. 38% of the zip codes in this country don't have a bank in that zip code. But guess what is in that zip code? Got a post office, right? The average family that's caught in this alternative financial services trap spends $2,400 a year. $2,400 a year on interest and fees once they get stuck in the trap of the payday loans and the check cashing operation. These are already low-wage workers. $2,400 a year. Postal banking happens all over the world. It used to take place in this country up until the early 1960s. If anybody's ever gotten a money order from a post office, I know I have. Anybody? That's a vestige of postal banking. And without ripping off the people, nonprofit banking done on some kind of fair administrative fee basis would bring in billions of dollars of new revenue and jobs into the United States Postal Service. So here we have a deep social need, and we have a postal service whose mission is supposed to be to serve the people. And so we're going to be working very hard in the coming months to promote and advocate that the post office take on some form of postal banking, and that we provide an alternative to the greedy private too big to fail banking system that we have right now. And we are not going to be seeking, at least the postal unions right now, are not going to be seeking legislation. We're going to be working with brothers and sisters like you all over the country to just make the post office do the right thing. So it's going to take a movement of pressure for the post office to take on and meet the people of this country where they need the post office at. And postal banking is one of those places. Lastly, brothers and sisters, we have at least, I don't know if it's a long and rocky road, but we certainly have a rocky road ahead of us. But I think it's important for us and the postal unions and for all of us to realize that we're not alone. And when we come to conferences like that, it's much easier to understand that we are not alone. When the workers in Wisconsin rose up 100,000 strong in defense of their union rights, what did they show? They showed the workers willing and ready to stand up and fight back. The newly created National Union of Healthcare Workers represents a bright spot of democratic and militant unionism in this country. When the owners of Republic Window and Doors began moving out equipment and closing the plant, we all know what the workers did. We're not alone. And I'm still marveling at the magnificent alliance that the Chicago Teachers Union forged. As far as it be, whether they had an R after their name or a D after their name. They fought the powers that be in defense of their jobs and in defense of the children and in defense of the parents of this city and of this country. And the Walmart workers are certainly stirring. Fast food workers are demanding not a minimum wage, but what? A living wage. A living wage. And in my home state, 80 to 100,000 people just marched. What they call the thousands on 8K on Jones Street, marched in defense of workers and democratic rights against the Tea Party controlled governor, House, and Senate. And there, it's a great alliance because, you know, it ties in the question of those who want to engage in voter suppression as part of the attack on all of our rights, and also in the defense of workers' rights throughout the state of North Carolina and throughout the South and beyond. So, sisters and brothers, I'll end with this. From the workroom floor to the streets, from our neighborhoods to the halls of Congress, it is time. And I'm not saying none of it's going on, but let me put it this way. It's time to even better educate, organize, mobilize, and galvanize. If there's ever a time to stand up and fight back, this is it, brothers and sisters. Frederick Douglass raised many moons ago that power concedes nothing without a demand. And we have to demand. And I'll leave you with the words of our labor troubadour, Joe Hill. Because I do think, at the end of the day, we have to be looking at whether it's attack on the public sector, workers, the people of this country, private sector workers and our unions. We have to be looking at how do we, as working folks, get the power we need, get the kind of decent lives that we and our families and our neighborhoods deserve. So I'll end you with this. Joel. If we workers take an ocean, we can stop all speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill, fleets and armies of all nations will at our command stand still. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
And that wraps it up for this edition of Labor Radio. You are listening to Mark Dimenstein, the new president of the American Postal Workers Union at the Labor Notes Conference in Chicago a week ago. This has been Labor Radio, the only program of its type in Oregon or Southwest Washington, of the working people, by the working people, for the working people, every Monday night from 6 to 6:30. Put on your radar this Saturday, April 19th from noon to 1, a postal demonstration protest of privatization of the People's Postal Service at the main post office on Northwest Hoyt at Broadway. Noon to 1, join in Creative Actions, protest the privatization of the People's Postal Service. Thanks to our engineer, Danielle. This has been Jamie Park.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sold Out Music Festival happening now until April 20th at venues all over Portland. The Sold Out Music Fest seeks to bring together people of all generations and backgrounds to celebrate the music that helps to bind our collective culture together. Legends of New Orleans jazz, the luminaries of Brooklyn hip-hop, the queen of modern soul music, and more are performing together under one banner. Bands, venues, bios, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 6:30. Coming up next on KBOO Portland, it's Prison Pipeline.
A unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Show me the jail. Show me the prisoner whose life has gone stale. And I'll show you a young man with so many reasons why. But there, but for fortune, go you.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Tonight, I'm here with Doyle Smith, Executive Director of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon, or DDA of Oregon. Welcome, Doyle.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Doyle, tell us exactly what is Dual Diagnosis Anonymous?
Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon, which is commonly referred to as DDA, is a nonprofit organization that has a mission to help people who suffer from mental illness and addictions recover. It's considered a consumer-ran organization or peer-to-peer support, and we're located in as many as 32 of the 36 counties in the state of Oregon. We serve over 3,000 people, and we're in the Oregon State Hospital, we're in the county jails, we're in the treatment providers' locations, we're in PSRB housing, we're in psych wards, we're all over the state. We were recently in the prisons until we lost our contract at the end of last year. Right now, we are currently just in the jails.
So dual diagnosis means that people have a mental health challenge as well as an addiction.
They call it co-occurring disorders, and there's a manual that providers use to assess people with chemical dependency. It's called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, 5th edition, that just recently came out. That's actually classifying addiction as a mental health condition, too. So what normally has been treated as separate, if you're severely mentally ill, you're not receiving therapy, and if you're in addiction, you're not really receiving the mental health services that are appropriate. What we understand is that when these two aren't combined correctly, then one takes the legs out underneath of the other, and people do not recover successfully. What I'm saying is they need to be treated simultaneously. They need to be assessed appropriately, and where it's very prevalent is in the prisons and in the psych wards.
So Doyle, talk about your background and how you came to become executive director of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous.
My career started in 1995 when I was an alcohol and drug counselor at DePaul Treatment Center. I worked there from 95 to 2000. And I actually met Corbett Monica in 1998 at DePaul Treatment Center.
And Corbett Monica was the founder and executive director of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous.
Yeah, well, he is the founder, and he was the executive director of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon as of the end of last year. My job technically started January 2nd of 2014, so I'm pretty new at being the executive director of DDA. But my career started in 1995 when I was a counselor at DePaul Treatment Center, which is where I ran across Corbett Monica. In 2000, I left DePaul Treatment Center to work for an organization called ASAP. And ASAP was contracted to work inside the Oregon State Prison System, which was located at Columbia River Correction Institution. I was hired in 2000 as a contractor to work at what was commonly known as CRCI, and I worked in their Turning Point program. And while working in this program, I was an A&D counselor, qualified mental health specialist, living skills counselor, and towards the end, I was their primary release counselor, transition counselor that worked closely with the program services of that prison. Basically did a lot of the same work. And I was hired as the assistant director while I was working as a contractor from 2011 to 2013, which I was able to be mentored and supervised by the executive director of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous Oregon, Corbett Monica. And my responsibilities were to hold meetings, DDA meetings inside the prisons and do orientations and presentations around the mission of DDA and its effectiveness with people with dual diagnosis. It's very crucial to understand that risk factors, even the state of Oregon has what they call the Oregon Accountability Models, which assesses people in custody's risk factors. And one of them is the substance abuse, and the other one is mental health issues. And statistics show that 67% of people with mental health issues also have an addiction issues. It's not uncommon for people to self-medicate, which was my history of growing up.
And what exactly is self-medicating?
Self-medicating is when you suffer from an illness and you want relief. So if you're introduced to any kind of substance that gives you that release, you become dependent on it. Me, it was alcohol and stimulants. And I suffer from attention deficit disorder. I actually flunked the first grade because of it. I didn't pay attention. I couldn't learn very well. I was taken to the principal's office and spanked for being unruly and disruptive. And lo and behold, later on to find out that I suffer from an attention deficit disorder. On top of being in a home full of abuse and dysfunction with addiction and mental health issues. My mom was manic depressed and alcoholic. My dad was in prison. I started getting help when I was 25 years old. And it wasn't until I was 33, after four treatment programs, incarcerations, hospitalizations, detox centers, psych wards, to where I was able to really address my issues. They call it a biological, psychological, social disorder. So you're not just treating one aspect of a person's life, you're treating actually three of them. So, you know, when I realized that there was so much more to this that needed to be impacted, and when I really understood that and got the proper services, then I was able to recover. I have over 21 years of consistent recovery from drugs and alcohol. I just celebrated my 21st anniversary, March 10th. People that see me in meetings and do presentations, the first thing I say is I'm loud and proud to be a man in recovery from mental illness and drug addiction. And the reason why is because it killed my mother and it killed my sister and it tried to kill me. And once you understand this illness and understand how to address it and do those things necessary, then recovery is possible and there's hope.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What are the numbers in the prison system of people with dual diagnosis?
The numbers are, it's challenging to talk about the numbers. There's a high need for people with substance abuse to be having their mental illness addressed. Over half the people incarcerated have a mental illness condition, and over 80% have a substance abuse or addictions issue. And when we say mentally ill, we're not always talking about diagnosed, but having problems associated. And I can give you a perfect example. Is I do the orientations in the intake centers at Coffee Creek, is where the men who are incarcerated and sentenced to go into the state institutions are funneled through their intake center. And up until last year, we were holding orientations once a month in two locations at Coffee Creek. And the men would sign up to come to my orientation just to get out of their cells. I mean, anytime you can sign up to be in a program to get out of your cells, and then they do it. It's not always because they want to. But what's interesting about this is that there would be anywhere from